Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 71. My name is John. I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse, singing, "We're gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50 amp fuse." Sometimes, I would dare say even most times, things are connected. The old saying in politics is follow the money. I've been harping about government interference on this podcast for years, so it should come as no surprise to you that I try to tell my friends that when they see government stepping in to solve a problem, they should look at the history to see what government did to cause the problem. And then sometimes you have things happen that may not seem directly connected until you realize it's not connected per se, it's parallel. Let me put it to you another way. Did you ever see the first two Hangover movies? Spoiler alert, but these are two movies that are 5 years old or more, so your fault. Four guys are supposed to have an evening of celebration for a bachelor party. But something goes wrong, and three of them wake up the next day unable to remember anything, and the fourth one is missing. The hotel room where they wake up has been trashed, and there's an exotic animal in the room. One of the characters has something strange done to his face. The three try to piece together what happened to find the fourth friend that is missing. In the course of their adventure, the most inept of the group is in charge of taking care of a small living thing. I'm trying to be delicate about that. One of them has what many Americans would consider to be taboo sex. They have run-ins with gangsters, and free an entrapped Asian man. At the end, when they all think their missing friend is lost for good, they have a sudden realization where he is and find him trapped back at the same hotel where they woke up. Then, they race to get back to the wedding just in time, where one of them confronts a surly antagonist with an "I'm not going to take any more of your shit" diatribe. The wedding takes place, and then they find pictures of their escapades from the previous night. So, for those of you who have seen both movies, which one am I describing? If the exotic animal is a tiger, the strange thing that happens to the guy's face is a missing tooth. There's a baby that the idiot has to take care of. There's sex with a prostitute, and Ken Jeong is trapped in the trunk of a car. Then it's the first movie. If those things are a monkey, a face tattoo, the monkey again, being topped by a transgender woman, and trapped in an ice maker, respectively, then it's the second movie. I've been telling people for years, Hangover 2 is the same damn movie as The Hangover. This also works pretty well for the first two Avengers movies. I mean, the bad guy manipulates the Hulk into going on a rampage. The team argues and fights with each other just as much as they do the enemy. The final battle is against a seemingly endless horde of identical creatures. But, hey, Kobe Smulders is in it, so nothing else matters to me. Two or more events happen, and people don't realize, at least initially, that they're really just the same damn story. So, that being said, a group of people is protesting what they perceive as wrongdoings by the government. When the protest began, there were concerns it could turn violent, and eventually did. The media and commentators are putting a racial spin on it. Many citizens blindly follow the media narrative because it passes the filter of their particular political bias. Am I talking about the Black Lives Matter protests? Or am I talking about the Bundy occupation in Oregon? I'm going to read from an article published by the Los Angeles Times about the Oregon protest. The standoff took shape in early January, when about 15 men and women took over the wildlife refuge after a march in support of Oregon ranchers Dwight and Steve Hammond, a father and son who had been sentenced to prison for setting fires on federal land. Over the weeks, protesters issued a muddled set of demands for ending the occupation. They demanded freedom for the imprisoned Hammonds and asked that the federal land be returned from the U.S. government to local landowners, the county, and the town of Burns near the refuge. And they made it clear that they were willing to resort to violence if the federal government moved against them, but also said they did not want such a confrontation. The number of armed occupiers continued to dwindle Thursday as just four people appeared to be holding out by late morning, surrounded by a large show of federal law enforcement that had blocked off roads to the area. In the interviews with the Times, Sandy Anderson and two others, including her husband Sean, conveyed a complicated position. They said they would leave peacefully, but only if they are assured they will not go to prison. They said they had not spoken with an FBI negotiator since about midnight. They noted that since the occupation began on January 2nd, many people had been able to freely come and go from the refuge. That changed Tuesday, when several leaders of the occupation were arrested during a traffic stop north of Burns, and one of them was killed. In the hours afterward, law enforcement set up roadblocks around the refuge, but allowed several people to leave without arrest. Some were arrested, however, including three, on Wednesday. All three faced the same charge faced by the eight taken into custody Tuesday: a federal felony count of conspiracy to impede federal officers from discharging their official duties through the use of force, intimidation, or threats. The small group remaining Thursday repeatedly said they faced what they viewed as an impossible choice: being arrested, wrongfully in their view, or being killed by law enforcement. When a reporter noted that their choice was not necessarily between going free and dying, that they could yield to law enforcement and the judicial system, as others who left the refuge had, they rejected the notion. Sandy Anderson said, "You think we're going to put ourselves into a corrupt court system?" Wow. A bunch of people dealing with government overreach and injustice, fearful of the corrupt court system. Any possibilities of parallels with the Black Lives Matter protests? Reading now, this time, from an article in The Atlantic. Black Lives Matter, the civil rights protest movement that rose to prominence after Michael Brown was shot and killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, expanded its reach onto the campaign trail and college campuses. The movement forced presidential candidates to reckon with a legacy of racism and police brutality. It inspired student protests and demands. Deep distrust of established political power has made many in the movement wary of any kind of engagement with either Republicans or Democrats. Still, many activists believe that the election is important. When President Obama leaves office, it will mark the end of an era. There is a sense of urgency over what happens next. Student protests also reach new heights on college campuses around the country. High-profile protests at the University of Missouri and Yale University over discrimination and racial insensitivity led to resignations at both schools. Civil rights agitation on college campuses is nothing new, But some movement leaders say the protests are proof of a fundamental shift in the mentality of a younger generation of activists. As activists confront obstacles, the movement has experienced growing pains. Social media has been a powerful tool for activists, but the public nature of the medium makes protesters uniquely vulnerable. Documents obtained by various media outlets through the Freedom of Information Act detail how the Department of Homeland Security monitors the movement on social media, and many activists believe they are under surveillance. So, let me clear a couple of things out of the way before I get to the real meat of these protests. First off, you'll notice the obvious tone of these articles. The Oregon protest article is critical. The Black Lives Matter article is sympathetic. I'm sure if I pulled articles from Fox News, it would probably be the reverse. Of course, this is what I mean by the media narrative. If you're a conservative Republican, you think that the guys in Oregon are peacefully protesting their constitutional rights in the face of an unruly government, while Black Lives Matter is a divisive movement that calls for violence and the destruction of property in the very neighborhoods they claim to try to protect. And there are tidbits of truth in that. If you're a liberal Democrat, you think that Black Lives Matter is an honorable cause seeking justice in the face of atrocities, while the Oregon protesters are just a bunch of selfish, probably racist, quasi-terrorist morons clinging to their guns and religion. And there are tidbits of truth in that as well. But the media is never unbiased. If you think your Fox News or your CNN or your MSNBC is unbiased, then you're part of the problem. They will all present you facts, but with their political ideology spinning the facts to subtly nudge your opinion one way or the other. Notice, the Oregon protesters are described as militant. This is a word usually associated with terrorists, or, as the liberal media calls them, Islamic militants. Let's juxtapose for a moment that the sympathy of the Atlantic article was applied to the Oregon protesters. You would probably read in the first paragraph, "The Oregon protest, the property rights protest movement that rose to prominence after father and son ranchers Dwight and Steve Hammond were prosecuted under a 1996 anti-terrorism law and had been sentenced to 5 years in prison for setting fires on federal land, dwindled to 4 protesters after one of their leaders was shot to death during a confrontation with government authorities at a traffic stop." See? It all depends on what they want you to think about it. They want us fighting each other. The only way they can take away our personal freedoms is if we are too busy bickering over our differences to notice the government, with a complicit media, quietly eroding our liberties away. That's why the Oregon protesters are portrayed as a bunch of hateful rednecks, so their cause is automatically negated. That's why the more racially divisive people in the Black Lives Matter movement are highlighted to delegitimize the protests. If you only use one facet of the media for your information, you're being played. If you only watch Fox News, you're being played by the conservative agenda. If you only watch, well, pretty much anything else, you're being played by the liberal agenda. They can't monger their fear unless they give you a reason to be afraid. They want us to distrust each other. They want you to distrust your neighbor. They want you to focus on racial divisions. They want you to be afraid. And how can they present to you freedom-destroying legislation under the guise of offering security unless you're afraid? There is no denying we are all different. But the elitists want you to think that skin color is enough to bond you together. Pick a race, any race. The elitists will tell you, based on the color of your skin, you're supposed to think a certain way, vote a certain way. It's all programming designed to keep everyone in their place. Trust the politicians who claim to represent you. Give them your vote and watch them maintain the status quo. Sure, they throw some pittance amount of money around after they've taken from others in the form of taxation, which fosters more resentment, and siphoned off their oversized cut of the bounty. And they do something for you, just enough to keep you complacent, just enough to make you think they're doing something for you rather than using you to accumulate power. I guess that makes them the Matrix, and you're unknowingly in the pink goo. Their plan makes you think that the differences must put us at odds with each other. So, if you fall into lockstep with one side or the other, you probably feel a lot of enmity towards the supposed opposition. Now, this is the point where I could easily go off on one of my rants about how the Republicans and Democrats are two sides of the same coin, and they are a duopoly designed to play off each other while they grab more of our freedoms. But that's for another time. Yes, if you listen to the media, there's so much difference with these two protests. Those differences are scary. The situations are scary. So you should be afraid of those other people. You know, the ones who don't look like you. The ones who don't share the same political affiliation as you. Don't fall for the racial narrative. It is only meant to divide us, to put us at odds with one another. While the citizens fear for their lives, the bureaucrats who actually hoard the power use it to pit groups against each other. The lesson of both situations, the parallel, if you will, is that you can't trust the government. The government is force, and they use it how they see fit, without honor or fidelity to its own rules. Hold that thought, because that's going to be key at the end of the podcast. Commentator Joe Pags made a point about the Oregon protesters, and it is similar to what other people have said about some of the other situations that have caused the Black Lives Matter protests. They broke the law, so they are only suffering the consequences of their law-breaking. Yeah? Well, what if the law is bad? What if the law is unconstitutional? What if the actions of law enforcement are blatantly excessive? What if the judicial system fails the citizens because of a horrible bias in favor of government power and control? Good people have a duty to disobey bad laws. If government has overreached beyond the Constitution, siding with government simply because it's the law is tacitly agreeing with the illegal actions of the government. So, no. Just because they broke the law doesn't mean they deserve to be put in jail. No, just because a guy was selling cigarettes doesn't mean he needed to be choked to death. I mean, who needs a 5-year mandatory prison sentence for a fire where no one was injured? Why the hell can't an adult sell cigarettes? These people are dealing with a gigantic load of shit they shouldn't have to because we let government run amok. People are dying because of excessive government force. People are going to jail for excessive amounts of time in relation to the crime that was committed. If you have to wait before the victim matches your skin color for you to be pissed off, you're part of the problem. If the person's skin color or political beliefs give you an excuse to not support their mistreatment, you're part of the problem. If you deride a person's support for your cause because you think they're just playing off the guilt of their skin color, you're part of the problem. I keep telling you that you can't really fight for freedom until you fight for someone else's freedom. If you're Christian, you should support gay marriage. If you're atheist, you should support religious freedom. You don't have to agree with the morality or logic. You just have to let others do what they want, so long as they're not damaging the rights of others. One of the pages that I follow on Facebook posted a quote modeled after Martin Niemöller's famous answer about how the Nazis took over Germany. This quote is by Lyle Meyer. When they took the Fourth Amendment, I was quiet because I didn't deal drugs. When they took the Sixth Amendment, I was quiet because I was innocent. When they took the Second Amendment, I was quiet because I didn't own a gun. Now they've taken the First Amendment, and I can only be quiet. The Bundy protests in Oregon and the Black Lives Matter protests may be run by flawed people who you may disagree with politically. But if they want to stop excessive force and overreach by an unconstitutional government, why would you not lend them support? However, after all that, here's a point not many are talking about. As much as people want to support a protest against the government, there's an intriguing side note that puts it all into a different perspective. Now, I'm reading excerpts from an article by the Mises Institute. There is always the temptation to immediately side with whomever it is that's on the receiving end of the federal government's heavy-handed court system and regulatory state. However, in none of these cases has the private sector ranchers been advocating for anything we might call free markets. Indeed, the federal grazing programs have long been a subsidiary scheme for a small number of favored ranchers. We often hear about grazing fees as if there was some kind of ordinary market transaction going on between ranchers and federal land bureaucrats, but this is hardly an apt description for what's going on. In fact, federal grazing fees have virtually nothing at all to do with any functioning marketplace. And we can see this in the fact that fees have been essentially unchanged since 1978. In this research paper from the early 1990s, the author notes that federal land set the federal grazing rate at $1.23 per animal unit mouth. The rate has hardly changed since then. As of early 2013, the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service were charging $1.35. That's an increase of 9.7% over more than 30 years. Ranchers who use federal lands are getting an excellent deal. They are getting such a good deal, in fact, that we might say they are being subsidized by everyone else. Influential ranchers are well aware of the advantages of federal control of grazing lands. This is why many ranchers have opposed state-level efforts to have state agencies take over federal lands. Unlike the federal government, private landowners in most states have to balance their budgets most of the time, which leads to higher lease rates all around. The rock-bottom lease rates mean the federal government runs at a loss. In the real world, and in the world of state-level and private sector grazing, People who want to lease lands must compete with others who might bid up the price of lands in question. This is not the case with BLS and Forest Service lands, which shield the current holder of the lease from competition. Thus, it should surprise no one when powerful ranchers become concerned about possible privatization of lands or state takeovers of federal lands. The federal government owns a majority of the land in 5 U.S. states, and the current standoff is taking place in a state where the federal government owns nearly 53% of all land. And only a tiny portion of this goes to national defense agencies. Of the 640 million acres owned by the federal government, only 14 million of those acres are administered by the Department of Defense. Nearly all of these lands are administered by agencies dedicated to wildlife, forestry, and other natural resource management. Thus, it should be no surprise when we hear that yet again, some ranchers are having problems with the nation's largest landowner, the federal government. The federal government likes to pretend that the federal lands belong to all of us, and that they are your national forests. But of course, they are not yours or ours at all. The fact that federal lands were closed, with armed guards stationed at the entrances during the last government shutdown, tells you all you need to know about whether or not these lands belong to you. On the other hand, it's best not to jump to conclusions about who homesteaders are. During the Bundy standoff, many advocates for free markets were claiming that the Bundy family had homesteaded the disputed land, and that it should be handed over to them. Given the realities of federal grazing leases, however, this is not at all clear. Given that the Bundys did not have to compete with other ranchers for leases, and that they are likely leasing at below market rates, a subsidized price, it's not at all clear that the Bundys would in fact be the rightful owners in an unhampered market. As I've noted in the past, the decentralization of land ownership down to the more localized levels is a good thing. There's nothing special about the state level, though, and while moving to state-level public lands is a step in the right direction, it is only that. For example, free market critics of those who want to reduce the extent of federal lands often correctly point out that the anti-federal activists aren't really for private ownership. They just want state control instead of federal control. And yes, there's nothing magic about the state level. If political realities did not preclude it, public lands such as national parks should be further decentralized to become county parks, or even lands owned by even more local entities such as private homeowners associations and municipalities. The city of Denver, for example, owns 14,000 acres outside the city limits as part of a system of mountain parks for the use of Denver taxpayers. If one has a problem with how these lands are used, it's a lot cheaper and easier to take a trip to City Hall and get a meeting with council members than it is to hire a DC lobbyist to influence a Senate full of multimillionaires 2,000 miles away. The public is indeed an abstraction, and it becomes more of an abstraction the larger the public gets. Any sort of communal ownership, whether it's a local government or a greenbelt owned by a homeowners association, comes with its own set of problems. But the worst possible model of all may be a block of 600 million acres controlled by a set of unaccountable bureaucrats living far away from the lands they control. There is indeed a big problem with the status quo. Will rushing to the aid of freeloading and negligent ranchers change anything for the better? It's unlikely. Wow. That's a whole new perspective, isn't it? Maybe this became a protest for the over-the-top prosecution of two of their own, but the root cause may just be about maintaining the sweet cattle grazing costs that they have enjoyed for decades. The cause is less about property rights and more, perhaps, about who gets the benefits of the government bounty. And isn't that also what Black Lives Matter is ultimately about? Why else would they go after Republicans and Democrats equally? They know, especially with the Democrats, that they can get more pull in the government on their behalf. Already the candidates are rushing to say who can promise to do more. This isn't a get government out of our lives request. Rather, it is a demand that government intervene more in their favor. More government. That's just as dangerous a road to travel as the one we are on now. In fact, it keeps us on the same road to ruin. It just presses the pedal down to speed things up. And when you're driving down the road to ruin, it doesn't matter whether you're in the right lane or the left lane. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.